Like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. It's 9:05 on May 4th, 2023. Please silence all cell phones. I'm joined by Senator Hoffman, co-chair, Senator Bishop, Senator Merrick, Senator Wilson, Senator Keel is also here. Senator Stedman will be by shortly. Want to go ahead and start with the three bills we got going on this morning. Are Senate Bill 53 by Senator Klayman. We heard that yesterday. Planning on trying to move it out today. Senator Stevens, Senate Bill 89, Senate Bill 133 by the governor. So on the bills previously heard, we'll bring up Senate Bill 53. By Senator Klayman, involuntary commitment. Please come on up to the table and invite... Identify yourself and just give us a short synopsis as we go for the CS, which is version O is before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Senator Matt Klayman, Senate District H. I think as I testified previously, I support the CS as drafted. Just a couple of things I wanted to note in response to some of the discussion that we had, that in particular there was some discussion about whether this bill creates kind of what I would describe was described as two different tracks for involuntary commitments, and in this bill itself does not create anything that doesn't already exist in terms of what I would describe as short-term psychiatric care and long-term psychiatric care. The bill doesn't create any distinctions between them. There's a practical difference of those who are there for long periods, as Dr. Becker testified. Some have been held as long as 9 years, but the process that in which they determine whether they stay or don't stay is not treated any differently than anybody that comes in for the first time. They look at the same standards, they look at the same decisions. There's no legal distinction between how they're treated. There is a practical reality that they have long-term patients and short-term patients. And we don't have, I think, as she testified, we're probably going to be facing challenges in terms of how many beds available and the need for those beds. But this bill doesn't create those challenges. The other thing that I just wanted to note with respect to the bill, this bill closes the gap that has been much discussed between folks whose case may be dismissed based on incompetency and then starting an involuntary commitment proceeding. And that the one thing I just wanted to make clear for the record is that the actual process in court whereby a involuntary commitment proceeding is filed in the terms of this bill is actually a fairly simple process. The court is likely to have a form that's one or two pages. It'll take a pretty short time for the prosecutor to fill that out before the charges are dismissed. And that in itself is not going to be a complicated process. The more detailed questions about who's raising competency questions and whether those folks are found incompetent or not competent is not really changed by this bill. That's already in statute.
Okay.
And unless there are questions, those are all the comments I had.
Well, Senator Klayman, just to let you know, the longer we sit talking about the bill, the less chance it has of moving out. We ran into that trouble yesterday. So I'd like to open up to amendments. I'd like you to stay at the table as well and give your comments or your position on the amendments as you bring them up. Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Before we move on to amendments, would it be possible to let Nancy Mead finish? I did have a couple of questions for her. We didn't get an opportunity to ask questions of her due to timing shortage.
Who is it?
Nancy Mead, the court liaison.
She is. And please come on up and join us at the table, Ms. Mead. You're welcome to stay there, Senator Klayman. We have some additional questions for you, especially related to the courts. And so, Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Mead, as we talk upon, you know, as Senator Klayman talked about sort of not having a two-tier system, does the court see a difference in sort of a short-term, long-term system and how that will be rectified? If someone's asking for a civil commitment, can someone ask for a longer civil commitment and a shorter civil commitment and just how that works? And furthermore, does the courts have any issues with the current system as it works now in terms of civil commitments?
Ms. Mead.
For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. Through the chair to Senator Wilson, I'm not absolutely certain what you mean by two tiers. I mean, with this bill, it is the case that somebody who previously had been found incompetent to stand trial and subsequently admitted for the beginnings of a mental commitment could, after a period, after the periods of commitment in the statute, be additionally committed for a five-year term. And that is only available if that individual had previously been found incompetent to stand trial. So in that regard, it's different from somebody who enters the mental commitment system without previously having been found incompetent to stand trial.
Senator Wilson.
Yes, I guess my question is then, if someone was going to be found for 5 years, could they just go ahead and commit themselves for the 180 days and just bypass the 5 years if they're already committed? And would there be a problem if someone says, well, why am I sit here for five, and this person who also has a similar mental health condition, very concurrent, why are they at 180 and I'm at 5 years?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, I do understand the question. That is the case that somebody who is in the system not having as a result of being found incompetent to stand trial in a criminal case and enters through the normal way of entering the system cannot be committed for 5 years. They would have a 180-day commitment and possibly another 180 and another 180. And as Dr. Becker testified, there are some people in that long term, but they're serial 180-day commitments. And this does set up a different system for somebody who had been previously found incompetent to stand trial in a criminal case. They would not be going through necessarily, it depends on what the professional person files, a 180-day. Instead, it could be done once with a five-year. So that is a distinction based on the fact that they had been found incompetent to stand trial. So I think that is what you are asking.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson?
Yeah, it is. And are the same hearings sort of the time frames for the under this potential bill, Senate Bill 53, and the normal civil commitment process, are those the same in terms of going before the courts and the same time frames and the same?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, yes, this sets up the three-day evaluation, which is, again, what most mental commitments start with. During that three-day evaluation at API, if the professional person in charge believes that, indeed, the person continues to be mentally ill and likely to cause serious harm to self or others, that person can file a 30-day mental commitment. There's a hearing. They can file then afterwards, if they think further commitment is necessary, a 90-day, and that's the same for these individuals, and then 180-day. And what this puts in is, and if your original commitment came from a criminal case where you were found incompetent, there's an additional option for those individuals to be committed for the five-year. And that is not an option for individuals that didn't enter the system after a finding of incompetence.
Thank you.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson? Any other members of the committee have questions for Ms. Mead and the courts? If not, thank you very much for coming up.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. We're ready to take amendments. I'll go ahead and object to each of the amendments for an explanation. Amendment number one by Senator Keough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number one.
And I'll object for explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should just start by thanking the sponsor and your office for this committee substitute. It makes some really material improvements in the bill and addresses some of the concerns I had. The one that lingers is that last piece, which is the potential for the government to hold somebody who has not been convicted of committing a crime for up to 5 years. It's longer than I am comfortable trusting the government, and it is longer than I think we can justify either medically or constitutionally. So the amendment takes a maximum 5 years down to a maximum 2 years. That is still four times the longest commitment we have today. The reason that I am this amendment takes it down to two instead of leaving it with the system we have now, that we heard the medical person say works with 180-day check-ins, is the powerful testimony we heard on the bill from the person who was stabbed. This is a very different setup than anything else we do, and we just heard that conversation. And it's not a situation we have where someone comes in who was found incompetent to stand trial for a property crime and turns out to be mentally ill and so mentally ill that they're dangerous. This is just when an individual, an Alaskan, got hurt. And with that concern for the victim and the likelihood that they relive some of that trauma when they get a notification that the person may be released, I think there is a rationale for allowing a longer commitment. But when we go to 10 times the maximum now, we raise not only constitutional questions, but fairness questions for somebody who never had a day in court. Frankly, it's tough to get here when the medical person said the system we have now works okay. But this allows another situation where the government has to come in and has to prove that this person is still dangerous at 2 years. 2 years is a long time to hold anybody who hasn't been convicted, especially since this applies to any felony charge for a crime against a person, some of which you don't do 2 years for if you get convicted. So 2 years I can get to, but I think we have serious both constitutional issues and freedom issues with being protected from the government if we go beyond that.
With all due respect to Senator Keel, I guess one of the questions I have is as you're looking at the issue of the person that has the mental issues, how do we protect society when they are, especially if they're out in a rural area and they don't have the backup with the law enforcement there or somebody to go ahead and kind of protect them? How do we assure them that they are still safe?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The situation we're talking about here is people who are already hospitalized, who've been in our locked mental health facility for 30 days, for 180 days, and the medical people, based on their medical judgment, say this person is still dangerous, seriously mentally ill to the point of danger. So they're in this case, it's almost always going to be Anchorage. They're at API. Or one of the places where in future we might have a facility like this if we build another one someday. And if they are still medically dangerous, then that hold will be renewed just as it's renewed today. But it'll be longer before the victim has to see the possibility that they might be released. Sure. So that's a help to them.
Do you have any other questions from members of the committee for the maker of the amendment? Senator Bishop.
I have a question for the bill sponsor.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Senator Klayman, does this two-year defeat the purpose of the bill?
Senator Klayman.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the two-year doesn't completely defeat the purpose of the bill, but the five-year period is, in terms of what we've really consistently heard from Angela Harris, the woman who's testified to, that difference between 5 and 2 years in terms of the assurance she receives and not having to go through hearings as frequently. Today, every 6 months, she's going and listening to hearings and worried that the person who stabbed her is going to be let out. And I think from the victim's perspective, the 5 years gives a level of insurance that you don't get with 2 years. By the same token, the bill has provisions that Senator Keel is referring to that allows a person who is safe and it can show the court that they're safe to be released. The court could impose a five-year commitment, and then the bill specifically would allow that person to be before the court again in 6 months, showing that they are no longer the danger, and the court would have to decide whether or not they could still keep them in. So I think the constitutional provisions or the changes to address the constitutional issues are already in the bill, and that the five-year commitment gives a level of assurance for victims that 2 years does not. I totally agree that 2 years is much better than 6 months.
Follow up, Senator Bishop.
I just personally, as one individual, I don't know the bill as well as you do because you've been working on it from day one, but I just don't want to see somebody back at the table if we pass this bill that's been committed and then is back out on the street and stab somebody else. And we're back here having the same conversation. So that's where I'm at, you know.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. you know, I have similar concerns as Senator here from Juneau with this piece of legislation. You know, we've heard several folks from testifying and probably give the same spiel in an upcoming amendment here. I think that there is a difference between a not having someone go through the due process as going through the legal system, being judged by their peers, and sitting in a confined space, basically like sitting in the hospital ER room for 5 years without having that time frame, without having that opportunity to continue to be reevaluated. And I think that we have a problem there. Also, we heard testimony from API and from the courts that they believe that the system for these longer term that will do an increase, and that's not a portion of this bill, and we'll work on this next year and subcommittee process of API would need money to basically renovate their facilities, because it's, you're basically confining someone who has less freedoms and longer term. Not saying that's right or wrong, but these folks do have some rights and should be honored as well. And I think that with victim notification that's been added into this piece of legislation, someone does not have to go to trial if they choose not to, but they will still be notified on those outcomes, similar to what we do now for the criminal system for the fine link. And I think that we should, I do support the amendment before us on amendment number one.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Olson. Senator Klayman, is there any way to assure someone that has gotten better on medication and whatnot and then is released from API, how do we know that they're going to continue their medication?
Senator Klayman.
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, the most significant way that API can manage that is actually keep them in an involuntary commitment, but allow them on an outpatient involuntary commitment. And API actually does that today. Dr. Becker had testified at a previous hearing that they have 10 folks that are on long-term commitments. 9 of them are at the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. 1 of them is an outpatient setting. Statutes specifically allow them to convert from inpatient to outpatient if they find that that's reasonable under the circumstances. And so the best way is to actually continue with the current system that allows continued supervision on an involuntary commitment basis in an outpatient setting.
Thank you.
Any other question from the bills or the amendments sponsored by members of the committee? If not, Senator Klayman, if you haven't already said it, would you want to go ahead and comment on the amendment?
I, for the reasons I think I thought I said, we don't support the amendment.
Okay. One of the questions I have for you, though, is that as you look at the ability of the Institute to go ahead and handle those people that are maybe marginalized, unrehabitable, how do you stop the backup so that the 10 beds that you have dedicated for that don't start backing up with 40 behind it and then 50 next year and in 10 years or in 5 years, you're up to 100?
Mr. Chair, one of the key parts of this legislation is it allows the courts to release people that are in restoration process or being evaluated for competency to vote those people, if secured, to release them on bail. So instead of having everybody has to be in custody to do restoration, it gives more ability for people that the courts believe can be safely out of custody to have that custody take place, not in the inpatient setting. As Dr. Becker testified, there's efforts already to increase the amount of outpatient evaluation and restoration efforts. So that's one of the ways you relieve the backup.
Okay. Okay. With that, I'll remove my objection for the amendment. Is there any other objection to the amendment?
Jeff.
Okay. We'll have a roll call vote.
Senator Bishop.
No.
Senator Keel.
Yes.
Senator Merrick. No. Senator Wilson.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Yes.
4 yeas, 2 nays.
With that, the amendment passes. Next amendment up is amendment number 2 by Senator Wilson. Senator Wilson.
Amendment number 2 will not be offered.
Amendment number 2 has been withdrawn. Next up is amendment number 3. Let's keep it brief at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Next up, we'll have an amendment number three. I'll go ahead and object for an explanation of amendment number three.
Mr. Chairman, I move amendment number three.
I'll object.
Yesterday, we heard some testimony from the Department of Law. Is it my understanding they needed some direction one way or the other, and this amendment gives them that direction. The Department of Law shall notify a victim in the dismissed criminal case at the time and place of the hearing, the length of time for which the respondent is committed, and the findings of fact is made by the court, and when the respondent is discharged from commitment. At the end of the day, this amendment allows the victim to attend the hearing.
Any further questions by members of the committee for the amendment sponsor, Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, does this amendment give the victim access to the person's detailed medical records, their medical file, and beyond what is discussed in open court, which obviously they'll be able to hear?
Senator Bishop.
Senator Wilson.
Let's take it. Finance Committee back to order. Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, this is a conversation that I had with the Department of Family and Community Services and with the court system as well on how these proceedings are happening. If someone in the public and if this Amendment 3 were to pass, a victim in the case would be able to attend, but the court proceedings would change to not to disclose any of that detailed information. And that's what currently happens now in other cases in courts. But I will say there is a chance that something may slip during this process and a victim could inadvertently probably do a third party breach of information privacy slip, which then could have the respondent go after that victim. So there is a possibility that that could occur, and victims need to be aware of that opportunity as well and should treat what they hear as some of that with confidential information if medical information does slip up by a prosecutor, or a defense attorney or the judge themselves. So with that, it's with caution. I do support the amendment. I do believe victims should have that right to hear and to participate in the proceedings and to be notified. But the respondent also has those rights to some of that information and privacy as well. And so it's a very fine balance, but I do believe the courts.
All up, Senator Keel.
I wonder if we could hear from the sponsor on it.
Okay. Senator Clayman. Would give you a perspective on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do support the amendment.
Okay.
And the reason is I do think that a victim should be able to attend the hearing. I think the hearing would be made very apparent to the victim that it's a closed hearing and that the information they hear is confidential and they shouldn't be disclosing that to anyone. And I think that will be told to the victim routinely, and I think they'll understand that.
With that, I'll go ahead and withdraw my. Oh, I'm sorry, Senator.
Senator Wilson. Make sure that it right now it's not confidential what's said in the hearing. So I just want to make sure that people understand that the victims can do that, and it's not a confidential hearing. So I just want to put that out there because there's nothing right now in this bill or in other statutes that makes that confidential in this proceeding.
Senator Clayman, you agree?
I know Corey Mills is here. I'd actually defer.
Ms. Mills, please come on up and clear us up.
Stacy. Stacy in the back.
Oh, Stacy. Stacy would be much better to answer this question.
Stacy sounds good too.
Come on up and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the record. Stacy Crayley,
I'm the director of the Civil Division of the Department of Law. Through the chair, someone asked a question, I don't remember who, about confidentiality. Hearings are confidential, Senator Wilson. Right now, a civil commitment hearing is confidential under state law. So that isn't a difference, but I do agree with Senator Klayman that in these instances, if individuals do attend these hearings, they should be cautioned and instructed about the confidential nature of the information and to maintain that confidentiality after they leave the hearings.
So just follow up then.
Senator Wilson?
Should we put that in here, that the victims should be notified that these are confidential? Because otherwise they would just attend, and under presumption of law, they may presume that it's not because they're invited. And so I just don't want someone to go in and go home after a disappointing hearing and just start blabbing on some social media outlet. I didn't know if that would be, if they need to be notified not to do that.
Ms. Crayley, do you have an answer for him?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, you could add a provision that would make it clear that participation or attendance in the hearing and the hearings are confidential. I do believe that that is part of the process. I mean, we, as the Department of Law Civil Division, when we prosecute the civil commitment hearings, I mean, we understand that. I don't know if that's really necessary, because the hearing in and of itself and the entire statutory scheme is rendered confidential. So I would assume if there was a third party attending a hearing, a court would explain the nature of the hearing and the confidential nature of what was happening.
Bob, Senator Bishop.
Could we have Ms. Mead ask her if she'd like to chime in? And
Ms. Mead, would you come on up, please?
Sorry, just want to make sure it can be victims.
Thank you, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I would agree with Ms. Crayley that these are generally confidential. This is one exception, and I would trust that the judges would say to those present, this is confidential, you're entitled to be here, but it would, you need to maintain the confidentiality after you leave. I suppose there's no way to literally enforce that, but that would be a caution from the judge that I believe would be routinely given.
Thank you.
Any final comments?
I would just note the comment in the other part, the structure of the closed hearings is that somebody comes in and then the judge's assistant closes the doors and locks the doors and no one's allowed in. And so the victim would be very much aware that this was a closed proceeding and not a public proceeding just by the way the process goes forward. And I think that the importance of that close would really come through to the victim.
So your perspective on the amendment is?
I support the amendment. I don't think it needs further amendment to tell the courts to tell the victim that it's a closed hearing.
Okay, I'll remove my objection for the amendment. If there anybody else that wants to object to the amendment? If not, the amendment passes. Next, we have amendment number 4.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move amendment number 4.
I'll object for explanation.
Mr. Chair, amendment number 4, basically, we've heard from Department of Law, the courts, the sponsor, that there is a problem currently in the system. And I think that everyone agrees that after someone is found incompetent, no one files for the continuation of an evaluation. This amendment still leaves that in place, where it allows the prosecuting attorney to mandate them to go ahead and file. And it also includes the previous amendment that we just passed, similar to Senator Keel's statements on amendment number 1 on some of the issues that we see happen. We've heard this from mental health advocacy groups, sort of their concerns with having a 5-year now, it's a 2-year in volunteering commitment, that the process works. We've heard from the court saying, and the API saying, that we may have a problem later down the road of we need to build out the capacity of our facilities, which we currently don't have. During this process, we heard from the prosecuting attorneys on the backlogs of some of these situations and issues. And this is just trying to keep a one-tier system so we don't have those future problems or suits coming before the state of Alaska before. So that's basically the gist of amendment number 4. It just takes basically down from the 2 years back to the 180-day cycle, which everyone says works just fine.
Any other discussion by members of the committee or questions for the amendment sponsor? If not, I'll remove my objection. Is there further objection?
object.
Chairman, can we hear from the bill's sponsor?
Sure. You're going to continue your objection, Senator Keel?
I will maintain an objection.
Okay. Senator Klayman, would you give your perspective on the amendment and its validity to what you're trying to get done?
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not support the amendment. The amendment, actually, the key part of this legislation is that it not only requires the prosecution to file the petition for involuntary commitment, but it actually then has the person held for 3 days and starts the 30-day commitment process. And by taking that process out, the gap that exists today would continue to exist if this amendment passes. The second reason I oppose the amendment is that part of the bill has specific provisions to allow folks to be bailed out if the court believes they can be out on bail and doing their evaluation for competency and also restoration. And this amendment would actually take those provisions out that are part of the way we're trying to relieve some of the pressure on the system for the folks that we're evaluating for incompetency. So for both of those reasons, I do not support the amendment.
Okay. Any further discussion on this amendment? If not, Senator Keel.
Just briefly, Mr. Chairman, it's allergy season. I want to expand a very little bit on something the sponsor said, that the potential for outpatient restoration of competency. So they've been arrested. They are not, in the initial evaluation, competent to help in their own defense. There's a period of attempt to restore their competency so they can be tried for the criminal behavior that's at issue. The possibility of outpatient restoration, that has some real potential. There have been advances in medication, including some of the long-lasting injectable parenteral other medications that may make things possible today and especially in the near future that we don't have today, that will get at some of that backlog we have, people waiting in jail before we can try to restore them. So some of those things I think are good, and I would like to see them stay in the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wilson.
I will go ahead and withdraw amendment number 4 and offer that at the next opportunity.
Okay. The amendment has been withdrawn. With that, any other discussion on this, of the amendments or on the bill itself? Not, is there a motion? Senator Keel?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Finance Committee report out Senate Bill, CS for Senate Bill 53, version 33 LS0172/O, as in Old Harbor, as amended, with individual recommendations and with forthcoming fiscal notes.
I'll object real quick, Mr. Chair.
Senator Wilson, speak to your objection.
I just feel that this bill is a good piece of legislation with good intent to fix a problem that it's established, but I do believe this will cause a myriad of legal challenges within the disability community, mental health communities, as we are, we'll have some imbalances on how systems are going to be handled. But with that, I know that this is a process and bills are sort of lively documents until the final passage, and so I will remove my objection.
We have no further objection to the moving of this bill. Without objection, this bill moves out of committee. We'll take a brief at ease as we sign the papers. call the Senate Finance Committee meeting back to order. This is the first hearing for Senate Bill 89, the Age of Tobacco and E-Cigarette Tax, by Senator Stevens. He has his staff, Tim Lampkin, here. You're going to have some opening remarks, Senator Stevens, and then we'll have your trustee aide go ahead and start the presentation. Please.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Olson. I appreciate your hearing this bill. Gary Stevens, Senate District C. This bill, Mr. Chairman, is very simply about protecting our children. Protecting our children from becoming addicted to nicotine. It's about clearly restricting sales and possession of nicotine products to youngsters here in Alaska. As you are all well aware, the tobacco and nicotine industry has acknowledged the decline in smoking around the country, around the world, and here in Alaska. And they have responded with a barrage of new options, of new smoking options, of fashionable smoking options. And that's in the form of e-cigarettes and the related devices that come with them. What they're designed to do is to appeal to a wide range of consumers, but particularly to our young people. They carry a message of their products being safe and harmless. And it's working, Mr. Chairman. It's becoming a public health crisis in this country. To not act on this issue is to turn our backs on every other governing body that's been involved in this, including our military leaders, our teachers, and our parents. We have deferred this issue for simply too long, Mr. Chairman. The time really is now to face this industry, to protect young Alaskans who are being targeted for potentially a lifetime of addiction and health issues. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. Mr. Lampkin, go ahead with your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. We've been working on this legislation, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, since about 2014. This legislation, or something very similar to it, passed the legislature last year and was vetoed. So I'm beginning to feel like I'm repeating myself as we go forward. E-cigarettes emerged, just as a brief history, emerged on the market in the United States, at least in 2005 to 7, the time frame. Originally, it was patented during World War II, but was shelved. And but since then, the decline in traditional tobacco cigarettes use, these products have exploded since that time on the market. Used to create an aerosol that you literally heating up a liquid that contains nicotine flavorings and a number of other additives and chemicals that users then inhale into their lungs.
Make a comment. I want to comment on the bill's sponsor. Thank you for tenacity in bringing this thing back, because it's the children there we're trying to go ahead and concentrate on, and so I appreciate your continued efforts over the long period of time, in spite of the obstacles that have been put in your way. Go ahead, Mr. Lampkin.
By using old tobacco marketing techniques, which is similar to what's on the screen now, manufacturers have secured their position for the foreseeable future. All they needed to do was pull out the old playbook that worked well in the 50s, and it's worked even in modern day. And to date, the e-cig marketing has gone unregulated. Recently, I'm hearing on the local radio stations advertising, come see us at our local vape shops, showing their popularity among celebrities, their appeal, and just simply being the cool thing to do among young people. The brands has paid for programs on social media, which is very popular among our youngsters, including Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, to promote their images and include company-sponsored ads that associate vaping with having fun and relaxation, freedom, and defying parents and students. So there's even competitions, how long you can hold your breath and keep it in, how big of a cloud you can make, and a variety of other things that just lead and contribute to more quickly becoming addicted. And inversely, and perhaps worse, the messaging has resulted in many students, young people, and particularly parents, believing that these products are healthy, are harmless, and entirely safe. These are a small sampling of recent confiscations that have occurred in schools, and you're going to hear this repeatedly from educators. Scores of products. This is a sample from an Anchorage school. It's happening in bathrooms, most predominantly. It's in the locker rooms. It's on the buses. It's in the hallways. It's even in the classrooms, because they don't always necessarily make a cloud. In fact, I understand that they've learned that the longer they do hold it in, the less of a cloud you can see. As you exhale, all you have is smell, something fruity or pleasant to smell, and you can shrug that off as a perfume or a cologne. Online, here's a small sample of disposable units. These are what we would call the closed systems. They're disposable, they're cheap. You puff on them, drag on them, take tokes, whatever you want to call it, a number of times, up to hundreds or up even thousands of times, a wide variety of flavors. Here, just to try to give you a sense of parity with comparing these products to cigarettes and how cheap they are, a pack of smokes these days. I went recently to the downtown supermarket, took some photographs of the rack of what these things are pricing for, and compared to traditional tobacco cigarettes, as they remain largely untaxed, they are quite cheap. You can get a unit for anywhere from five, maybe upwards of $10 per unit, which is equivalent to at least a pack of smokes, if not four or five. And then here, I want to remind the committee once again, this is the infamous Waxman hearings, where the top CEOs in the country, tobacco manufacturers, in 1994, stood on record under oath saying that their products were not addictive and they were not harmful, and we know where the rest of that story went. Mr. Chairman, these products are hazard. They are pervasive in our schools. I believe there's general agreement that e-cigarettes can be offer a pathway to quitting smoking from traditional cigarettes, and that the nature of non-combustible e-cigarette products are safer and less toxic. I may concede to that idea that compared to traditional smoking, that should not be translated or into an assumption that inhaling these alternative substances, particularly nicotine, into a young person's lungs is in and of itself safe or not toxic. E-cigarettes do not end addiction. They simply replace the delivery system for that addiction, the method of fueling the addiction. You're going to be hearing a lot of testimony about how wonderful it was to help someone quit smoking, that they've saved lives, that our military members should be able to have access to these products. And I will make a point that our military was among the first organizations to move and make these products a minimum of age 21. So our military does not want unhealthy soldiers. A healthy military is a healthy defensive force. You'll hear that the tax rate's too high. We can go into the details as to this tax rate is at parity with tobacco. All of these arguments, I guess as you hear them, I'd like to suggest that we keep our eye on the ball and ask ourselves, are we protecting the grown-ups here and their profitability, or are we protecting our youth from addiction? That concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy to go into questions or the sectional. I would also point out for the record that in your packet is an article last month that the company Juul has reached a settlement of $462 million being paid out to six states in the country for, quote, falsely telling high school freshmen that their products are safer than cigarettes. That's a substantial amount of money, Mr. Chairman. And also in closing, finally, I'd say that I took it upon myself to do an informal poll of all 500-plus schools in our state and have that packet information compiled and redacted in your packet, where the responses were overwhelmingly yes, that these are pervasive in our schools, that they're on the rise, that there's increasing confiscations, and this has to be addressed and supporting attacks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Do we have any questions by members of the committee for Mr. Lampkin or the bill sponsor? Mr. Lampkin, a question I do have for you, in this $462 million paid out by Juul, was that a settlement or was that a judgment?
Mr. Chairman, that was a settlement.
That was a settlement to the multi-state P people that were, I'm assuming, plaintiffs in the lawsuit.
Yeah.
It's certainly a significant amount. I mean, we're approaching things like we're just levied against Fox. So with that, with your permission, Senator Stevens, I'll have him go through the section.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
One moment. Again, Tim Lapkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Before you should be version U, as in uniform. And I'll begin by clarifying that many of the predominantly these this bill is so big for conformity. A lot of these statutes are already on the books, and it's just simply raising the age from currently on the books from age 19 to age 21. So section one relates to the sales of cigarettes, and that it's a violation for a person to sell to a person under age 21. However, the person receiving has to be 21. The person that's actually making the sale pursuant to a last committee's amendment, that person making the sale may be age 19. Section two relates to the supervision of vending machines that can have tobacco products in them. That if it's situated in a break room, such as a cannery break room, that's not otherwise supervised by someone that's age 21, that there be clear signage posted that it's illegal to possess if you're under age 21. Section 3 relates to possession of tobacco, ESPs, electronic smoking products, or products containing nicotine to a minimum age from age 19 to age 21, with some exceptions. Section 4 directs the court to establish a bail schedule, and that translates to treating the violations as a traffic ticket, such that rather than what's currently on the books have a mandatory court appearance, that this would instead allow a person to pay the fine and mail in a check. Section 5, oh, I should back up there. In Section 4, we also included a provision here that in the event that the they have economic strain and can't pay the fine, that they may also appeal to the judge to instead take an educational program on the harms and risks of vaping and use of tobacco. Section 5 prohibits the sale of electronic smoking products over the internet to private consumers, with exceptions in the following section. And this is a policy area that we may want to reexamine and a later time. Section 6 relating to the behind-the-counter provisions, similar to, say, at the local grocery store, you have to go to a customer service counter to buy tobacco. It's locked up behind a cage so that there's a person that's age 21 that's accessing those products. Section 7 relates to other tobacco products known as OTP, and this includes things such as chewing tobacco, patches, gum, things that generally are not something that you smoke. However, would clarify that informally, if it's wrapped in paper, it's considered a cigarette. If it's not wrapped in paper, it's considered OTP. And so that would therefore include cigars, cigarillos, because those are wrapped in a tobacco leaf. Cigars are OTP. So those things would then be changed from age 19 to 21. Section 8 relates to exemptions to selling products containing nicotine if they're FDA approved as a cessation product, prescribed by a doctor, or given by the parent or guardian. Section 9 relates to the requirement for vendors under this is vending machines that are dispensing e-cigarette products from age 19 to 21. Section 10 relates to the penalty for selling or giving a these products to a minor, punishable of a fine of not less than $300. That's for sales, too. Section 11 adds a definition of nicotine to include a chemical or other compound. This is essentially to cover what's increasingly emerging on the market as what's known as synthetic nicotine, as a way to try to skirt taxes or other laws. Section 12 relates to licensing requirements for buying, selling. Adds legal authority for our Department of Revenue to coordinate with municipalities and businesses to suspend their licenses, similar to how they can do so with tobacco. Section 13 relates to the wholesale cigarette sales, making, again, it's an age lift from 19 to 21. Section 14 relates to common carriers that are transporting and shipping these products, that they have to verify the age of the recipient, basically card them, similar to what you may have seen before, as we do with, say, wine that you buy or other products that are age restricted. Section 15 is where the state can partner with municipalities for sharing information on the taxing component. Section 16 adds a restriction for the transport of OTP in the state, required that there be licensing to do so, and that there be age verification. Section 17 is amending Article 8. It's a new article. This is the heart of the bill, if you will. It's where we establish a tax, a retail sales tax on e-cigarettes. That would include a 25% tax on the retail sales price, followed by 4350855, provides for some exemptions sold on military bases, that they're not be taxed on base, or if they're FDA approved as a cessation product, or we also are carving out marijuana products and hemp products. 4350860 requires retailers to be licensed to sell ESPs. 4350865 requires a monthly tax return to be filed with the state for e-cigarette products. 4350870 requires record keeping by businesses that are conducting business with for ESPs. 4350875 directs the taxes being collected to be accounted for and to be available for use for health care research and advertising related to the hazards of ESPs. Also, we added recently in the this current version to allow for relief to schools who are administering health programs and installation of ESP detection devices in school bathrooms, locker rooms, and so forth. Those are not cheap. 4350880 is a conforming amendment that allows or adds rather restrictions on shipping ESPs into the state without a license. 4350885 places restrictions on vapor products to include a cap in their nicotine concentration. We can go into that in further detail at some point. It includes requirements to protect from breakage and leakage, so we don't have youth that are accidentally getting into it. That it be labeled clearly, that it not have other additives that have been shown to be harmful, and that it be tamper and childproof. 4350900 includes a definition for sales price as a technicality for tax purposes. Also, 4550990 is other definitions of the products that we're talking about. Section 18 relates to the business license endorsements that are required, and that it raises the age from 19 to 21. Section 19 relates to, is again, kind of conforming amendments hereafter relating to the licensing and the processes for suspending license, appealing suspensions, penalties, and so forth. That would cover Section 19 through 21 administrative conforming changes. Section 22 relates to consumer protection. This is to try to touch upon the flavorings, whereas we're not outright restricting or banning the flavors, but it does make it unlawful to market them in a manner that would result in the youth consuming them. Section 23 is a carve out with our juvenile justice system that would that currently is on the books, that minors possessing alcohol or rather tobacco from age 19 to 21. Section 24 is a repealer relating to the sales of incarcerated persons. Currently, folks in prison, if they're under 19, they can have a smoke. That this would repeal that. Also allows repeals internet sales discussed in a prior section. Section 25 is applicability, and the overall effective date, Section 26, has, at the request of the Division of Tax, has moved to January 1, 2024, that is a quick summary of the sectional, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lampkin. Do we have any questions by members of the committee for either the bill sponsor or Mr. Lampkin? But before we do that, I want to welcome Senator Stedman, who's been away on other state business, is in the committee now. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lampkin, Senator Stevens, a question about making these tickets available. Does that mean that when a minor, someone under 18, gets one of these tickets, there's no need for their parent ever to know? They can intercept the mail, pay the thing, and mom and dad don't ever find out?
Senator Stevens.
That's an important question. I don't attend. Do you have a response?
Mr. Lampkin.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, currently there is a mandatory court appearance on the books. As was negotiated and compromised through the process last year, that was struck. So as of this moment, as I read the bill, I would agree that that a ticket could be issued and they could withhold it from their parents if they wrote a check or sent in payment on their own. We do have a representative from the courts here available that could probably more definitively answer that for you if you like.
Struck on a very important issue, Senator Keel, and I would not object if that were changed.
Senator Keel, do you want me to call somebody from the courts?
We can follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions by members of the committee for either the bill sponsor or Mr. Lampkin? We'll go to invited testimony then. First invited testimony is Sean Arnold, who's the principal of Thunder Mountain High School here in Juneau.
He's here.
On up and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, Mr. Arnold.
Hi, good morning. Co-chairs, Senator Stedman, Senator Hoffman, Senator Olson, and member of the Senate Finance Committee. My name is Sean Arnold. I am principal at Thunder Mountain High School, right up the road here in Juneau, Alaska. I just want to thank you for allowing me a chance to share my story with you today. I want to start by saying I am in support of Senate Bill 89. The bill is a needed step to help our children become nicotine-free. I started in school administration over 12 years ago. Dealing with students smoking cigarettes was a rare occasion back then. After many years of successful efforts there to curtail teen tobacco use, it seemed the nicotine fight was over, but in the past 3 to 4 years, we're starting to see the initial vaping and the e-cigarette use there in our schools. Unfortunately, we've moved from just a few occasions to a regular problem on a daily basis. This year, just in my school of 600 students, we estimate about 25% of our students have tried vaping or use vaping on a regular basis. The age group that we usually witness this is the younger students between 14 to 16 years old. They smoke nicotine cartridges, often with the flavors like bubblegum, apple, cinnamon, other fruity variations. This is how we often catch the kids there using them. When we walk by the bathrooms there, we smell sweet flavors there coming out of those bathrooms. Vaping has become so addictive that our students don't just vape in the bathrooms. We find them in the hallways, in the classrooms, in the lunchroom, sneaking these activities. When we ask the students that we find with this why they do it, they often report because it's harmless, that it calms them down, it's a way to relieve stress. Some students even admit that they're addicted to it and they can't stop that. Often I have students just turn in vape devices to me voluntarily because they said they don't want access to it. And if they have it, it's going to be a temptation. In our ongoing battle, I've confiscated at least 70 devices this year in a school with 600 students, at least one every other day. I ask students where they get it. Most of the time, they answer that it's usually an older sibling from another student kind of selling them on campus. Occasionally, they purchase them online, and in some cases, even their parents provide them. A low-end device is about $20,
that often students will resell to one another for about $40. We caught several kind of sophisticated exchange systems this year. So for example, students coordinate over social media. They kind of plan out that you can buy a device if you place money under a rock out in the woods at a certain place. And if you go, you know, later on after you put the money, there'll be a device under that rock. Often in these cases, we found that they were purchased by adults, somehow kind of benefiting in the profit sharing. Usually, again, it's an older sibling. The devices are getting smaller. They're more easily concealable. They look like everyday items, such as pens or flash drives. So we often think about it, it's who needs to hide their vaping habit? So it's not the adults who are trying to quit smoking, but it's often the kids who don't want their parents to find out, or, you know, adults and educators. At Thunder Mountain, we've revamped and ramped up our efforts there to share out the dangers of vaping. But there are a few services available in our community, like in many others, as far as like the old tobacco cessation classes. A Juneau ordinance does exist there on the books that possessing a vaping device for those under 19 years old, it can be punishable through a citation. But that's in addition to school discipline measures that we do take part of. Part of our requirements, so when we do find a device, we notify law enforcement who comes out and often issues a citation. However, those may or may not go anywhere due to challenges that that take place. So principals, we get into the profession to help students learn and impact the education of our youth. We should spend less time tackling the vaping problems when we have other things to work on with the students. Instead, there's not really much accountability for those with no regard for our youth's health and our state's future health to keep from getting worse. Please help us help the youth of the state by passing Senate Bill 89. And of course, just a quick, I guess, demonstration, if it's okay. I just want to share, just as an example, devices. This is just an example of devices just from the past couple of weeks that have been confiscated from students. They're anywhere from the $20 variety up to the $200 variety of devices. And so this is what we're kind of dealing with on a regular basis there. But thank you.
Mr. Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you for being here.
Sure.
I just wondered if they're buying $200 vape devices, how will the tax impact that for them to stop buying a $200 device? That seems pretty spendy.
Mr. Arnold.
Yeah, I don't know the best answer for that as far as the tax and the impact. I got to think that it may be a deterrent to help. My hope would be that some of the taxes collected would go back to support communities on the tobacco cessation, so it could reduce the use and of students. So.
Any other question by members of the committee for Mr. Arnold? Senator Keel.
Principal, thanks for being here. Are you spending any money on detection devices? I know, at least as of 12 months ago, there weren't any at JD.
Yeah, currently we don't have any detection devices anywhere in our district. We have explored vape detection devices as a means to reduce the behaviors as a deterrent. The average cost of what's on the market is about $1,200 for a device. We're trying to, you know, put that money to other uses. It's inexpensive. Speaking with principals in other districts around the state, they have put devices in place. Anchorage is an example that all the high schools have put devices. Kids are smart, and they often find ways to get around the devices. There's online YouTube tutorials on how to defeat the devices where they can blow smoke into bottles with cloth and other material to kind of reduce the chemical sense. In many cases, recently reported, at least in our principal discussions, we have regular meetings around the state. In Anchorage, there's an alert when a device detects a signal. It usually can send a text message to administrators who are on that link. The devices were sending so many alerts that the response, that was all the administrators were doing. So they disabled the devices because they just didn't have time to respond. Not that it's not a possibility, but the cost is fairly a big barrier.
Bob Sarek, you.
Thank you. In conversations with high school students in the last year and two, kids are planning their breaks. So they're planning when they're going to pee so that they don't have to go in the bathrooms where there's nothing but vape smoke.
That's right.
So there are educational impacts or student impacts. If you're not spending money on detection devices and Anchorage is having to disable them so that administrators can do anything else, what can you sort of quantify what educational resources you're having to divert?
Mr. Arnold.
Yeah, through the chair. The resources, definitely, it's time, staffing. In some cases, schools are dedicating a support staff member to check in students in and out of bathrooms, signing in, just so they have some oversight of what's going on. For us, we're instead of time supporting teachers, working on instructional planning, we're kind of dealing with these, the devices and the problems they cause. You know, there's some other disciplinary students fight over it, some other problems that bring. So we're seeing an impact as well in student athletics because it does count for under ASA tobacco, alcohol, drug violation. And so we have many students who are amazing potential that are taking the hit and losing a season or not participating in athletics just to kind of maintain and do this. So
thanks.
Any other questions for Mr. Arnold, my members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming in this morning. Okay. Next we have up is Karen Blossom, who's online, the assistant principal of the year 2023 at Wasilla High School. Ms. Blossom, are you on, ma'am?
Good morning. I would like to thank you for inviting me today. I appreciate the invite from Tim Lampkin. And I just want to say I am in great support along with the Wasilla community of Senate Bill 89. I'm very passionate about keeping our schools and students safe, including the health and general welfare of our communities and children. This year, 75% of our major discipline issues at Wasilla High School involved vaping, the distribution of vaping, and in two situations we had this year, we had to do a medical lockdown of our school because two separate students OD'd on vaping products laced with other toxic, illegal, and addictive chemicals. We are a school of approximately 850 students. Vaping is affecting our athletes. We are seeing this mainly in our younger students. 90% of our students caught with vapes in our school are freshmen. They are purchasing these vapes from the local community, their family members, and purchasing cartridges. Just like Mr. Arnold said, at the parks, et cetera, they are very easy to purchase, and we've seen vapes anywhere from $20 to $320. Each year, I've been the assistant principal here for the last 5 years. Each year, the number of students caught vaping or in possession of a vape is on the rise. Students are starting to vape in middle school. We've had multiple instances of students having more than 2 infractions in middle school. And by the time they are freshmen in high school, they are addicted to these vapes. I have had sophomores disciplined for vaping for the 3rd time in their school career. In the Matanuska Susitna School District, tobacco products have progressive discipline, meaning that this stays with you from the freshman year all the way to your senior year. We do have infractions because we have collaborated with our community and local schools. If you tell the truth that you do have a vape on you, your first infraction is a Saturday school, including an online vape educate class that will cost the family $20, which is vapeeducate.com. If you lie about having a vape, and we are able to find these vapes because the district have given each school a vape detector. If you lie about having a vape and we find it, it is 3 days out of school suspension. The second infraction is 3 to 5 days out of school suspension and a $500 citation from Wasilla PD. If you attend other schools in our district, it is their local police department to give the $500 citation, including Palmer Police Department. The third infraction is 10 days of out of school suspension, an educational conference with a school psychologist, and potentially another citation of upwards of $1,000 from Wasilla PD. The Matanuska Susitna School District has provided vape detector wands to administration in each school. Although not all schools have vape detectors, they are very expensive, and because of the large amount of students at our schools, we have multiple bathrooms. It is very, very costly. I highly support raising the legal age to buy or sell or possess e-cigs to 21 years old. I am imploring you to please pass Bill 89. It is taking up our resources in school. It is taking up the teachers' time in school. We have them check the bathrooms for us at the beginning of their prep periods. We do have cameras in the school, but the vape detectors are very expensive, and I feel that the taxes associated with the penalties involved with Senate Bill 89 can be used primarily for education of cessation of smoking, potentially the e-cigarettes and vaping, also for education within the schools. We do have posters in the schools when we ask students why they don't smoke. They say because of some of the advertisements that we have in the schools have helped them stop. But I am, along with other principals in my school, supportive of Senate Bill 89.
Ms. Bloxham, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Any questions of Ms. Bloxham by members of the committee? Senator Wilson.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Bloxham, for being available to testify on this bill this morning. About how many of the, if you had, you know, all available funds available to you, how many ESP devices would you put in Wasilla High?
Ms. Bloxham.
We have 3 wings of the high school. It would be just the bathrooms, the public bathrooms. We would have to have 9 of those if we included locker rooms. We would have to have 12 total.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson?
No, I'm just doing the math on that. If we spent the entire physical note on just these devices, it would average about 5 per school each year, so it would take about 2.5 years to fund that if we just use that just for these devices.
Okay. Any further questions by members of the committee for Ms. Bloxham? If not, thank you very much for coming out this morning.
Thank you.
Next, we have Joe Darnell, Chief Investigator for the Alaska Department of Health, Tobacco Enforcement and Youth Education.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Joe Darnell. I'm Chief Investigator for youth access for the Department of Health. And it's coming, whenever I talk towards the end of these, I don't want to reiterate it, everything that everyone said. Mr. Lampkin does a fantastic job on explaining everything. Both the principals paint a big picture of what we're seeing out in the field and in the youth. So I want to touch on the raising it to 21 from 19. Federally, it's 21. State, it's 19 to purchase tobacco nicotine products. Federally, the FDA enforces that, and if the store violates that and sells to a minor, they get a warning letter from the FDA on the first offense. If they sell to someone under 19 under state law, working with licensing, we can suspend their ability to sell tobacco and nicotine products for up to 20 days on their first offense. So to raise it statewide to 21 makes it a fair playing field across for the merchants, because there are businesses out there, not your national retailers, but more than not the mom and pops that are only enforcing at age 19, because they got that 2-year window of customers that are from 21 to 19, and if the FDA gets them, they'll get a warning letter, and then they'll just up and start enforcing at 21. So this would, raising it to 21 would give a fair playing field for all the merchants. That are also makes it easier for the merchants when it comes to carding. In Alaska, if you're 21 or older, your driver's license or ID is set up horizontally when you read it. If you're under 21, it's vertically. So just when they go to cart, on which license they're handed to, the retailer will know if they're over or under 21. And I'd like to touch a little bit on the fines, because I know the youth possession stuff has come up over the last few years. Is it too high, too small? And we've heard in the past with that $500 fine. This bill has taken care of that and added, dropped the amount down on how much they can be fined, and also gives an alternative to that fine penalty. With that, that's all I have for you, and I'm available for any questions that you have.
Do you have any questions for Mr. Darnell, my members of the committee? Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Darnell, can you talk about the provisions that don't line up, the age to buy and the age to sell, and does that make a difference in what you've observed?
Mr. Darnell.
Yes, through the chair. I can see that as problematic, and I understand the thought process behind it, that we want to have jobs available out, but there's a lot of jobs out there that that have that you've got to be 21. For example, I'll use my niece for example. She graduated high school. She's a go-getter. She went and to the Teamsters and went through their apprenticeship to be a trucker, right? So she'll sit there. The union hall will call and say, hey, we've got a job at, say, out of Fairbanks for 8 weeks. Can you go up? So she'll go up. She'll work the job. She just turned 21 a couple months ago, and she was so thrilled because it gives her an opportunity for more work, because she had to be 21 to be able to haul hazmat. So there are jobs out there that do require that you need to be 21 to do it. So if 19 to sell, one of the things that's shown as a best practice is the farther we can have from the age of kids in high school to age of legally purchasing it, it's harder for the kids to have that social connection, right? So, but if they're allowed to sell at 19 and they have friends that are 18, and there's a possibility that they could. So I just see it problematic having them being underage as the legal age to sell.
Senator Keel.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning after Mr. Darnell. Next, we'd like to call up Katie Steffens. Ms. Steffens, are you on, ma'am?
Good afternoon. This is Katie Steffens. I just wanted to inform the committee that I am available for questions only today.
Do we have any questions for Ms. Steffens by members of the committee. If not, I've got some questions. Ms. Darnell, what education programs are there out there that are being used today to try and educate parents and children about the risks of vaping? Is she still on?
To the chair, I believe that question would be better suited for Ms.
That question was for Ms. Katie Steffens. Ms. Steffens, are you still on, ma'am?
I am. Apologies. This is Katie Steffens, through the chair. So we do have 21 grantees funded under our Tobacco Prevention and Control Program here in the state of Alaska and covered in all public health regions of the state. And 19 of our 21 grantees currently serve to assist schools with their policies and to work on implementing alternatives to suspension programs. We also have a contract with the American Lung Association who developed the program called In-Depth, and that has found to be a very popular and successful educational program in schools in Alaska. It was also piloted in Alaska before its official release and found that students who go through that program, by the end of it, about 60% of kids are very interested in quitting or would like to quit their use of e-cigarettes or other tobacco products. So that is one example of a program that's being implemented in Alaska, but there are other online options, such as the program that is through the FDA in collaboration with Scholastic that addresses middle school and high school education and youth. There's also Touch My Breath, and those are some free programs available for schools as well.
Okay. The other question I have for you, do you have data on school suspensions and tobacco vaping either in schools or in the communities to show whether it's on the rise or not?
To the chair, yes, we do. In collaboration with the Department of Education and Early Development, we have been monitoring school suspensions since it's been hard for us to collect data for our youth risk behavior survey. Our last collection was in 2019. So working with Department of Education, we've been looking at school suspensions. And in the 2015-16 school year, there were 414 school suspensions related to tobacco use or possession that included e-cigarettes. Since then, the amount of suspensions has increased 232%. So in the 21-22 school year, in the state of Alaska, there were 964 tobacco-related suspensions, including e-cigarettes. And these suspensions were found in all grades, 1st through 12th.
Okay, do we have any other questions for Ms. Katie Steffens by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Brandon Spanos, who's going to go over the fiscal notes, although there's 7-0 fiscal notes, or one with the impact of the Department of Revenue. Mr. Spanos, are you on, sir?
This is Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division, and I am actually don't have a public testimony. I'm available for questions or to go over my fiscal note.
Could you go over the fiscal note? That's what we want you to do.
Okay. Just one moment.
Take a brief at ease. Call the Senate Finance Committee back to order. Mr. Spanos, go ahead with your review of the fiscal note from the Department of Revenue.
Yes, again, for the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division. And I'll be going over the fiscal note. I'm not going to read the background section. It's the bill sponsor and the staff did a great job in describing what the bill does. And we just give background on how that would be implemented. But the revenue impact, there is there's no revenue impact for the change of the age from 19 to 21, as sellers have already adjusted their selling practices to reflect federal law. With that change, the department estimates that taxing the electronic smoking products at 25% of the retail price would generate an additional $3.39 million in revenue in FY24, growing slightly in future years due to market and population growth. This estimation assumes no inflation for fiscal note purposes. The bill designates the purpose of tax revenue collected for healthcare, health programs, education programs, and advertising related to the hazards of electronic smoking products. The department has reflected this revenue under a temporary designation, general revenue or general fund code. And we estimate that the license fee would generate an additional $70,400 in unrestricted general fund revenue. The implementation costs, this note does reflect higher implementation costs than similar bills like the one that was passed last year for seeking to tax electronic smoking products. The reason is that the past bills had broadened our existing other tobacco products or OTP tax. That tax is at the wholesale level, and this bill creates a new tax type at the retail level. And so it's broadening the prior bill where it broadened the other tobacco products tax, which just absorbed those electronic smoking products into it, would require only minimal changes to our tax revenue management system. And the fiscal note reflects the cost to stand up a new tax at the retail level. It would require developing a new module for the tax revenue management system. It would also, we're looking at adding two new positions, a tax auditor two and a tax technician two to run the licensing and return processing, auditing, customer service functions for those taxpayers, which would be the retail sellers of the electronic smoking products. And the staff would have an enforcement function that would require some travel and service costs, include annual overhead for facility rents, department and statewide core service rates. Commodity costs are included. They include a one-time cubicle build-out for the two new positions, and or for out years, it's reduced to just annual office supply costs. The department would need to engage our contractor Fast Enterprises to build those modules in the tax revenue management system and as I mentioned, develop that electronic smoking product module and including the licensing function.
Mr. Spanos, we do have a question by Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just that last paragraph of the note, it says that additional $500,000 is needed in FY23 supplemental costs. I don't see that reflected in the cost of the fiscal note.
Before we go on, Mr. Spanos, I guess my question has to do with which fiscal note number are you talking about?
So I'm looking at fiscal note. It's CSB89 LNC.
Number five, Mr. Chair, is of the
number
one.
Five, I'm sorry.
In OMB component 2476.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. Mr. Spanos, go ahead with the question that Senator Wilson had.
So through the chair, Senator Wilson, in regard to the 500 supplemental, we reflect that on page one under estimated supplemental FY23 costs.
Follow-up, Senator Wilson?
Yes, thank you. And then this, as you mentioned, this is no longer going to wholesalers, going to retailers, more like a sales tax. Do we know how many retailers that this would apply to in the state of Alaska, a rough guesstimate, and would just the one tax technician additional and the one auditor be enough to cover that, sort of those duties?
Mr. Spanos.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I know I've looked at that information. I'm going to have to get back to you, though, because I don't recall if we actually have it or if we just looked to see if we had it. There will be hundreds, and the two employees would be part of our excise group, which is a larger group, and many of the duties would be absorbed into that group.
And Mr. Wilson. Mr. Chair, I can count hundreds just in the Mat Sue alone. I just didn't know if that should be thousands in terms of retailers.
So through the chair, Representative Wilson, we will get back to you with either our estimate or with an that we don't have a number. I believe what we did was we used there is data out that's available with a NAICS code for businesses when they register for a business license. They have to get a NAICS code, and I believe we used that NAICS code for tobacco and then removed our current licenses.
Mr. Spanos, thank you very much. We have somebody in the room that's going to address the fiscal note, and that's Ms. Robb. Ms. Robb, please come on up to the table and identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your answer to the question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Sylvan Robb, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business and Professional Licensing. In FY22, there were 1,654 business license endorsements to sell tobacco products.
Okay. Senator Wilson.
And is that per entity, or is that just the main? So let's say Fred Meyers, for example, is that just the one Fred Meyers, or is that all stores covered, same for gas stations?
Ms. Robb.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, each individual location that is selling tobacco requires its own tobacco endorsement.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Ms. Robb by members of the committee? If not, thank you very much for coming up this morning.
Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, Senator Keel.
Mr. Chairman, I wonder if it's possible to ask Mr. Spanos another question.
Mr. Spanos, are you on, sir?
Yes, again, for the record, Brandon Spanos, Deputy Director with the Tax Division.
We have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Spanos, just practical terms for a business owner, if you sell both leaf tobacco products, cigars, cigarettes, whatever, and these devices, you have to file two returns with the state to do both the excise and the sales tax?
Mr. Spanos.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the current tobacco and other tobacco product taxes at the wholesale level, so the distributor is the one paying the tax and filing the return. So when it gets to the retail store, the tax has already been paid and the retailer does not have to file or pay a tax.
Well, Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's very helpful. I appreciate that. So it's not a dual burden on one filer. We're adding a couple of thousand, several thousand filers. The other question I think would be to Mr. Spanos, do you have enough auditors here to handle the online sellers, or would you work with there's a consortium doing online sales?
Mr. Spanos.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, I don't believe the current language has a tax on online sales. That may be a better question for the bill sponsor. But if it did have an online sale component, we certainly have some familiarity with how to audit that. But I don't believe it currently has. I think we may need additional staff if that were added.
Senator Steve, would you want to come up and address the question? Or Mr. Lamkin?
Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Through the chair, Senator Keel, currently as the bill is written, there is an outright ban on internet sales of e-cigarette products. That, as I mentioned through the sectional, is something we are interested in revisiting and opening that up, provided there is age verification and a tax that is paid.
Senator Keel?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Whether the outright ban remains or not, I think Mr. Spanos' section will still need to do some auditing.
Okay. Any comment, Mr. Lampkin?
Through the chair, or Mr. Chairman, that is a conversation I've had with the tax division. There is language available to help address that and make it as smooth as possible for online filing, similar to what I understand is happening in another piece of legislation coming up before this committee.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming up, Senator Wilson.
Yeah, on the issue of online sales, then, is it just against law to mail just e-cigarette components through the mail service now or any other?
Mr. Lampkin.
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, currently there are no such restrictions. It is happening online.
Sir Wilson. I guess my question is, will Senate Bill 89 just ban all carrier services from carrying electronic cigarettes, components or parts or devices?
Mr. Lampkin.
So I guess my question would be, could I have my friend in Lower 48 just mail me the components? It's not selling it. They're just mailing it to me.
Mr. Lamb?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, that's correct.
Thank you very much for coming up and answering the question. We're running short on time, so in cooperation with the or in consultation with the bill sponsor, we're going to have public testimony start here shortly, and we'll be 1 minute apiece. Opening public testimony. First up is Carrie Nysent. Ms. Nysent with the American Lung Association. Please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony. 1 minute, please.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Olson and committee members. My name is Carrie Neeson. I'm the Senior Director of Advocacy for the American Lung Association, and I really want to thank Senator Stevens for sponsoring Senate Bill 89. Tobacco use almost always starts in childhood or adolescence, and in Alaska, we have one out of four teens in high schools that are active users of electronic cigarettes. The American Academy of Pediatrics recently published an article entitled Protecting Children and Adolescents from Tobacco and Nicotine. The Academy cited several evidence-based policy recommendations, including increasing tobacco and nicotine prices. I also want to point out that the use of e-cigarettes is not safe. Nicotine is a highly addictive drug that can have lasting, damaging effects on the adolescent brain, and it impacts the cardiovascular system. Many of the flavor additives are menthol-based and food-related. These additives are approved for ingestion, not inhalation. And there's no scientific evidence that these devices are effective in curing the addiction to nicotine, and switching from cigarettes to other tobacco products is not quitting. Thank you very much for your time and for your careful consideration of this legislation.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next, we have Joe O'Connor. Mr. O'Connor. From St. Paul, Minnesota, please go ahead with your one-minute testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairman, and thank you, everybody. My name is Joe O'Connor, and I am the Director of Tobacco for Holiday Station Stores. I work in a merchandising department. Basically, I just wanted to say that, you know, a lot of times I sit in on a lot of these, and there are issues, and I don't want my kids smoking or vaping. But one thing about responsible retailer like Holiday is we don't sell to youth. And that's always the issue. It's youth prevention. We don't sell to youth. We train our employees. We reward them. And then if there's one infraction, that employee is terminated. In a tough labor market, that is a tough pill to swallow. But we take this very seriously. So I agree with a lot of what everybody's saying. But just to reiterate, I think we're going after the wrong area here, because we talked a little bit about online, and some people bought it in parts. Where the problem is where these minors are getting these items. So don't penalize the retailers. You know, we follow the rules. Alaska has a very large, we're in 10
states. Mr. O'Connor, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Next we have up David Parrott. Mr. Parrott, are you on, sir?
Yes, sir. I am calling in opposing SB 89. The tax in which it's being implemented, to me personally, feels like it's higher than last year's rate, in which you guys passed a tax that was a lot lower than this, but it was a higher number. If you look at what you passed last year, it was a wholesale tax. This 25% retail tax is equal to a 75% wholesale tax. So now you're making a less harmful thing more costly than the actual cigarettes themselves. If this bill is passed with the tax as written, it's going to make it more expensive for people who are already on a tight budget within the state. And you're punishing adults for the youth breaking the law. And that's where it gets really conflicted about this bill. To save the youth, why not go at the youth instead of punishing law-abiding adults who are trying to kick a nasty habit of cigarettes and get off of nicotine itself? Vaping itself has nicotine tier level to lower down the amount of nicotine you're receiving so you can eventually quit and get on with your life, but you're going to punish them for trying to do that. And that's why I stand firmly against SB 89.
Mr. Parrott, thank you very much for your testimony. Next up we have is Alex McDonald. Mr. McDonald, are you on, sir?
Yeah, for the record, Alex McDonald, Fairbanks, Alaska.
One thing I'd like to point out is in invited testimony, the testifiers didn't say that the youth were getting these at retail stores. They're getting them from friends and family. So I'm failing to see how punishing adults switching to the number one, from the number one preventable cause of preventable death to a less harmful product is going to deter youth. They're not shopping in stores. They're not going to really be affected by this tax. Also, for small businesses, we would have to file two tax returns every month, one at a local level and one at a state level, because there are no distribution centers in the state of Alaska that pay the tax. We have to order it from the companies. And then also, I don't get the additional licensing requirements if stores are already required to have a tobacco endorsement. It just seems redundant. And as far as the shipping, vapor products fall under the cigarette laws for shipping tobacco products. Congress changed that federally a couple years back in the budget, and they gave Alaska a carve-out for in-state shipping. We can ship within the state.
McDonald, thank you very much for coming out this morning. I'm assuming you're against the bill. Next we have up is June Rogers. Ms. Rogers, are you on there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Finance Committee. My name is June Rogers. I am a lifelong resident of Fairbanks, and I'm supporting testimony on my own behalf. I'm submitting testimony on my own behalf. I'm so sorry. It's an honor to have permission to address the state Senate Finance Committee about serious issues that confront the residents of our community. I am voicing my support for Senate Bill 89, the e-cigarette tax bill that raises the age of tobacco purchases from 19 to 21, which will conform with the federal law and provide a deterrent to poor purchase choices by our youth. I am deeply grateful to the supporters of this bill, and I am especially grateful to Senator Stevens for his continued diligence on this issue. I request that the members of the Senate Finance Committee join Senator Stevens' tireless efforts and support Senate Bill 89. Supporting this legislation supports a healthy community, and as I recently stated, every brick in the wall brings us closer to a healthy community. For several years, I have contacted legislators regarding the massive health issues that our families have encountered due to tobacco use. I do this in honor of my brother, who passed away much too young from throat cancer. And I do this to provide a safer world for
Ms. Rogers,
not only
thank
my
you very much for your testimony this morning. Next up we have is Alicia Kyle. Ms. Kyle, are you on, ma'am? 1 minute.
Good morning. My name is Alyssa Keel, and I live in Fairbanks, and I'm testifying on behalf of myself in support of SB 89. I am a part-time swim coach of a competitive swim team here, and the group that I coach are ages 11 to 14, and they do tell me that these products are easy to try and easy to get a hold of. They assure me that they do not use these products because they care about their health, but they do know that other athletes and other sports beyond swimming are using these products, and it's affecting the way that they play and work out. I just would like to stress the importance of supporting measures that discourage youth from acquiring and using these products. And please support SB 89. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Jennifer Chikoyuk. Ms. Chikoyuk, please identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is Jennifer Chikoyuk. I'm from Kenai, Alaska. I'm a lifelong health advocate and educator. I have the privilege of working with school districts across the state on this issue and know that they are in crisis. And so I'm grateful to Senator Vince for introducing this bill, and I encourage the committee to pass it out so we can get it onto the Senate floor next. Thank you.
Thank you for coming out this morning, and thank you for being brief. Next we have up is Elizabeth Ripley. Ms. Ripley, please.
Co-Chair Stedman, Hoffman, Olson, members of Senate Finance, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of SB 89. My name is Elizabeth Ripley, and I serve as President and CEO of the Matsu Health Foundation. Most tobacco use begins before age 18, before the brain is fully developed. The supermajority of adult smokers start smoking before the age of 18, when it was illegal. According to the 2019 Youth Risk Behavior Survey here in Matsu, 31.8% of traditional high school students and 49.9% of alternative high school students currently vape. Over 50% of traditional Matsu high schoolers and 71% of alternative high schoolers have tried e-cigarettes, which are erasing decades of progress in reducing youth smoking rates. We need to align state law with federal law by raising the minimum age from 19 to 21 to buy, sell, or possess tobacco and electronic smoking products, and we must establish a sales tax for ESPs, which didn't exist when Alaska adopted its current tobacco statutes. Without this bill, there's no level playing field for taxing tobacco and tobacco products in our state, and we're not protecting our children from a lifetime of addiction to tobacco. We encourage you to move Senate Bill 89 forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next up we have up is Tabitha Blades. Ms. Blades.
Hi, I'm Tabitha Blades, and I'm an assistant principal down on the Kenai Peninsula, and I'm calling in to support Senate Bill 89. In my role, I have daily contact with 700-plus Alaskan teenagers. Listening to the testimony today, I just want to say that at the school level, most school policies support out-of-school suspensions for students. So you're talking about children who are being sent out of school because of a device that, in many cases, in my experience anyway, are being supplied by adults who are buying them, you know, legally, like other people have said, sometimes by their own parents. But these kids are the ones that are being taken out of school, and there's no benefit to that, in my opinion, as an administrator. Also, it's laughable to me that people would say that it's a cessation aid for tobacco use, traditional tobacco use, not in the eyes of children. Let's keep things where they are. Keep them with the children. That's what this bill is about. Children are not quitting tobacco, traditional tobacco products. They're enjoying cotton candy and fruity pebble flavored poison. And I'm begging you as an Alaskan voter and as a mother to support Senate Bill 89. Thank you.
Ms. Blades, thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Emily Neenan. Ms. Neenan, please.
Good morning, Chair Olson, members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Emily Neenan. I'm the Alaska Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. I'll just hit on one point, and that is the disposition of proceeds, page 12, line 15. This is coming from section 435875. I really appreciate the efforts to get some of the revenues, projected revenues, going to tobacco and e-cigarette prevention efforts. I will offer that the easiest way to make sure that these revenues are going to comprehensive evidence-based interventions is to simply put them into the Tobacco Use Education Cessation Fund, which has been up and running as a designated fund for over 20 years supporting comprehensive evidence-based tobacco prevention. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning and testifying. Next we have is Jesse Walton. Ms. Walton, are you on, ma'am?
Hi, my name is Jesse. I'm calling from Fairbanks, Alaska. And I would like to testify on HB89. I oppose the bill. I started smoking combustible cigarettes at 15 when I was a ward of the state. I became an adult at 18 and a mother a month after. When I was 15, I was buying cigarettes through cab drivers. I would just flash them and they would go buy me a pack of cigarettes. So I don't think changing the age or adding a tax is going to prevent youth access. Thank you. I hope you guys have a great day. Bye.
Thank you very much for coming out this morning. Next we have up is Pat Patterson from Kenai. Patricia Patterson, please.
Hi, my name is Patricia Patterson. I have owned a tobacco store in the city of Soldotna for over 20 years. I do support this bill, but with two changes. Number one, the tax needs to be on the wholesale level. I am already filling out a wholesale tax to Department of Revenue every month and a sales tax every month. This would make it a third form. This would allow implication with no extra cost, no position, no module, no enforcement, no travel. It would just be an additional schedule that I'm already doing every month to the Department of Revenue. The second change I would like this to be made is to allow adults from 19 and 20 to be able to sell this product. yes, I understand that we feel that selling this product, you need to be 21, but these are adults and they need a job and they should not lose their job purely because they are 20 years old. This is, I think, unnecessary to allow the adults in Alaska to lose their job.
Ms. Patterson, thank you very much for your testimony. Next we have up here in Juneau is Vicki Jo Kennedy. Ms. Kennedy.
Yes. Good morning. Yeah, Vicki Jo Kennedy, and I'm still here in Juneau. Hey, I am in total support of Senate Bill 89, as I am a 53-year-long cigarette smoker. I know how detrimental tobacco products can be. I myself went to Gay Street and found the Tobacco Alliance, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago, and said, how in the world did you ever allow something like this to even get on the market? Because it's totally targeted towards children. I mean, they spent all that money to try to get us off cigarettes. They got $55 billion to try to take us off tobacco, and it worked, you know, the tobacco quit line. But this is just ludicrous, and get total support, 21. Now, make it 51 for all I care. And a flash for a pack in Fairbanks, that's going to make me giggle all day. Anyway, selling these e-cigarettes to kids is a bunch of malarkey. So let's get her done with 89. Thank you, guys and ladies, very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kennedy. Next we have up is Megan Bolter. Ms. Bolter from New Mexico, please go ahead.
My name is Megan Bolter. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're coming in loud and clear.
Great. My name is Megan Bolter, and I'm a public health law attorney practicing in the area of tobacco control-related disease for the past 18 years. I work for the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation, also known as Tobacco 21. We've worked with various state and health agencies to develop model policies that include tobacco retail licensure and point-of-sale requirements. We were supportive of SB 45, the Mirror Barefoot bill from last year, and we strongly urge you to support SB 89. To date, Alaska is one of 11 states or U.S. territories which does not have a state T21 law. It's a step to ensure that Alaska differentiates itself in bringing forth a state prescription for restricting new sales by holding non-compliant retailers accountable for illegal sales of these products, and not the youth who have been captured by deceptive and predatory marketing, which was referenced earlier in this community by the number of settlements with Juul, one of the leading e-cigarette brands associated with youth tobacco use. I know we're low on time, but I just want to reiterate that SB 89 is aligned with federal law adopted in 2019, which raised the age from 18 to 21, with the U.S. Department of Defense's declaration prohibiting the sale of tobacco products to anyone under 21. On
Ms. Bolter, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Our last testifier is Shell Hamill. Please go ahead with your testimony from Texas.
Yes, good morning. I would like to thank the bill author for this bill as it addresses the youth access and prevention, but I believe that it does little to meet its mark because of caps. While the youth usage continues to be a serious concern, an ABC documentary found over 700 teens polled. 80 of them received these vapor products from a friend or a family member or a straw purchase, which the FDA commissioner has said that was a serious concern. I would like to propose a different route. According to the FDA compliance data, zero inspections were done in Alaska for vapor stores or vapor products, where 309 inspections were done. One can conclude, if there's a problem with youth usage, why are no inspections of the stores being done regarding vapor products? Alaska is reported by the CDC to have received $10 million to reduce education. I would imagine that we could probably do some more inspections with this. The FDA compliance data also shows that another answer could be to place these products in age-restricted stores, tobacco stores, vapor stores, liquor stores, where they have time to and more attention. They can pay more attention to the purchaser's age. Seems like that would be a better use of this money. I'm hopefully you will find a way to address this.
Ms. Salma, thank you very much for your testimony this morning. Thank you for coming out, especially all the way from Texas. I want to go ahead and say that I would apologize for the Senate Bill 133 that we were supposed to be hearing by the governor. The Opioid Remediation Fund will be heard at a later time. Brief at ease. Finance Committee meeting back to order. This concludes this morning's agenda. This afternoon we'll be hearing Senate Bill 114 by the Rules Committee, which is the oil and gas taxes. Take public testimony on that. With that, we're adjourned at 11 o'clock.